This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Lassell.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, here we are, another year over and a new one just beginning.
And it's expected that by the end of 2014, there will be millions of Americans newly insured and many of them newly entering the healthcare system.
Margaret, I think it's also interesting to note that part of the story that isn't getting mentioned as often, it's expected some 15 million low-income Americans will be covered by Medicaid expansion. That will be a significant number of new, fully insured American citizens.
And perhaps will have a profound impact on things like use of the emergency room and bad outcomes to chronic illness, the consequence of lack of prevention. So a terribly important aspect to the healthcare law because it really aims at protecting the most vulnerable populations. And I do believe this will have an impact on the public health.
The White House also announced another option for those Americans whose insurance plans have been canceled and they can't find coverage at a similar cost. They will not be charged a penalty and can opt for a catastrophic coverage plan that was reserved for Americans under 30 years of age.
It's kind of a short-term pleasure, I think, because I want to remind people that you really are much better off finding a plan that covers all the essential benefits that the healthcare law calls for. That way you really get value for the dollar and much more comprehensive coverage, including prevention.
All of these changes in health policy are affecting the medical profession as well, and our guest today has a keen insight into that side of the equation.
We're revisiting our conversation with Dr. Ardis D. Hoven, president of the American Medical Association. She'll be talking about the policy initiatives underway to help practitioners get up to speed with all of the changes impacting healthcare in this country, from health IT adoption to changes in payment to really the transformation of delivery. And AMA, along with other professional groups, are working very hard on the policy side to try and protect the interest of folks in the profession, as well, of course, as their first obligation, protecting their patients.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, stops by.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love hearing from you.
We'll get to our conversation with Dr. Ardis Hoven in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. 2014 is barely underway and the changes continue to the health law. Open enrollment start date is being delayed to November in this year. And while only half the number of folks signed up for insurance in the online marketplaces during the current enrollment than the White House had hoped for, business will continue to be brisk, according to analysts, and should continue to keep a steady pace. The Young Invincibles not turning up as much as they had hoped either. Those young folks under 30 who would need health coverage and could qualify for a catastrophic health plan. So far, those numbers have fallen short of pace and expectation. And the view around the states, well, it depends on where you are. If it's California, New York, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, or Connecticut, the numbers show robust activity on those state-based exchanges. But the states without exchanges are seeing many more challenges for folks interested in shopping for health coverage online. In Colorado, the sign-up has been slow, even though they have set up their own exchange. They are sending mobile units around to grocery stores as one method to capture folks who need to sign up for health coverage. And in Iowa, distance is an issue. Lots of rural folks are far from any center where they might gain assistance, helping them with those online insurance marketplaces. The multi-billion dollar vitamin supplement market has taken a hit. A recent study out shows that they, for the most part, do very little good for someone's overall health and may actually do harm in cases. The study cites the importance of gaining nutrients directly from the foods you eat. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ardis D. Hoven, the 168th president of the American Medical Association and the third woman to hold that position in the nation's oldest and largest physician organization. Dr. Hoven serves as the AMA representative on the board of directors of the National Quality Forum, which seeks to improve healthcare delivery in this country. Dr. Hoven is an internist and infectious disease specialist focusing on HIV/AIDS in Kentucky, where she also served as president of the Kentucky Medical Association from 1993 to 1994. She's a member of the American College of Physicians and Infectious Disease Society of America. Dr. Hoven, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
You know, we are in a new phase of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, and your organization, the American Medical Association, has over 200,000 members. Since taking office in June, you've said that it's time for the medical profession to embrace the Affordable Care Act and start to exploit the law's potential for improving public health and the health care profession. So can you give our listeners an assessment of where your membership stands?
Well, as you are aware, we knew at the front end that the Affordable Care Act was not a perfect piece of legislation, but in fact, it had some very important elements that we thought very important to support and would continue then to work on making adjustments and changes to correct the things in the legislation that we felt were not in the best interest of the American people. Having said that, the physician community has actually been leading in much of the change in some ways out there. If you think about what is happening now in work around models of care, delivery of care, so the physician community has taken up a significant lead here in helping to enact many of these changes.
Well, Dr. Hovind, I think we'd all probably agree that the art and science of medicine are undergoing some significant changes in the way we're delivering it to the public. And so you talked a little bit about some of the changes around things like care coordination and changes in how teams are arranged that are beginning to make a difference. But what do you think the most dramatic changes for the medical profession are going to be, and particularly for physicians on the front lines?
Well, what we see is that we know we have to innovate and change the way we deliver care in this country. It's not just about delivering care, it's also about the cost of care, the quality of care, and the health of our patients. And so we see one of the most important pieces of this is looking at how healthcare is being delivered. Various models of care. For example, we've seen work around something called accountable care organizations. We talk about the primary medical home model, another way in which particularly folks with chronic diseases are well managed to their betterment and to improving the quality and cutting down on the cost. So there are a lot of different models in play out there. This is where the big change is going to take place, and the physician community is ready to embrace this. So those changes out there are underway, and we will direct our attention to them and be appropriate in our responses to them.
Dr. Hovind, we're going to see millions of more Americans entering the healthcare arena, and where there's predicted to be shortages in the primary care providers. I know the AMA's Liaison Committee on Medical Education has advocated strongly for an increase in medical schools, and there are a number of new medical schools opening up across the country. What vision does the AMA have for responding to the growing healthcare needs and making the ground more fertile for enticing medical students to choose the path of primary care?
Specifically, the AMA's work has been directed in many ways around one of our new strategic directions, as you alluded to, which is medical education reform. And we know that in this country we have more medical students, we have more medical schools, we have more patients to be seen, and yet we have an obstruction, if you will, in the whole concept of graduate medical education, which is that training piece which occurs between graduating from medical school and then going out into practice. So the AMA has been very specific in looking at GME funding, how that's going to take place, but is also now looking as part of its strategic focus on ways of changing educational innovation. Team-based care is going to be taught in medical schools. It's being taught now. Team-based care being physician-led care, but at the same time allowing all healthcare professionals to function at their highest level of training and expertise. And it's that team care that's going to afford us the ability to manage the care that we want to provide in this country in a more efficient and timely manner.
Well, Dr. Hovind, it's my understanding, I think, that the Council on Graduate Medical Education has once again convened to really take a look at what might need to change. Can you give us any window into the kinds of changes? Are there other changes in terms of distribution or investment of resources or strategies to get things right in this country that you expect to see or to at least be considered?
What we're looking at now is we look at these various innovation models, and there have been 11 schools that we have awarded grant money to look at this, so that we have competency-based training as opposed to just calendar training, that we are looking at pathways that are more efficient in the use of educational time and exposure that young men and women need. And most importantly, being able to develop and continue to maintain, if you will, their excitement and enthusiasm about doing primary care, for example. We're going to see change occurring, and we're looking forward with great excitement to this.
We're speaking today with Dr. Artis D. Hovind, the 168th president of the American Medical Association. Dr. Hovind, the AMA has been very active in promoting a better system for Medicare reimbursement and the so-called SGR formula, which stands for sustained growth rate. And I think our listeners might be familiar with this annual fix that goes on, sort of called the doc fix. And our current Congress, though, is quite a contentious lot. But there's talk that there may actually come to some type of agreement on SGR's reform soon. So can you tell us the efforts that are underway and what you think would be the ideal solution for fixing the broken Medicare reimbursement system?
It's a very important issue. And one reflects over the last 10 years, we've had 15 patches to the SGR. Now, what we mean by that is threatened cuts based on a formula that doesn't work anymore. It's based on the GDP, not on providing care. Threatened cuts to physician reimbursement, and that has been a big destabilizer, if you will, within Medicare. And it's threatened many practices. And it's very disconcerting for our seniors out there every year to see Congress debate this and then at the last minute, at the 11th hour, patch it, kick the can down the road, and wait till one more year appears. This year, the AMA, along with our physician colleagues in the state and specialty societies throughout the United States, collaborated together and came up with a plan to tell or help Congress fix the problem. And it's not only to repeal the SGR, which is the first step, but it is then the second part of this, which is to provide 5 years of stable reimbursement to physician practices so that they could then begin to work on the infrastructure to moving towards innovative models of healthcare delivery, as we were talking about earlier. It's these models of delivery of care which are going to be best for patients, improve health outcomes in this country, and at the end of the day, going to save on the cost of health care. And so this is what we have presented to Congress. We have been very pleased with the positive uptake, both sides of the aisle, looking at this and saying, yes, this is something we should do, we must do. And I am much more optimistic than I have ever been in years past about our ability to see this change. Now, again, the climate is difficult, but this is something that is fiscally responsible. If you think about it, we've spent over the last 10 years $146 billion patching Medicare. It's the right thing to do for this country, and it's the right thing to do for healthcare in this country.
Well, Dr. Hovind, when we look at how we're going to increase both the capacity of all primary care providers as well as influence those outcomes, whether you look at virtual visits or telehealth, other members of the healthcare team serving in roles as primary care providers, as well as ancillary staff, community health workers. I'm sure with 200,000 members and in states all across the country, these things have to be met with somewhat equal parts of enthusiasm and resistance. And I wonder from where you sit, how you work with the different regions and the states and the stakeholders, what's your structure to try and build a consensus? And I guess the second part of that would be, do you see a generational shift kicking in where a new generation is sort of rising up within medicine that sees things differently?
Well, let me start first with how we get the work done and how we determine our policy. The AMA actually represents about 185 states and specialty organizations, so all 50 states, and then the balance being the rest of the specialty and subspecialty societies in the United States, are represented by delegates to the House of Delegates at the AMA, which is the policy-setting body of the organization. It's a very democratic organization. It's done by consensus votes. We have supporting caucuses that provide information and input into the organization as well. So at the end of the day, the work product has been very carefully looked at by a variety of individuals in a variety of practice settings, specialty settings, And at the end of the day, we come out of the room having joined together, using our tools and expertise to good use and to good policy. The AMA then takes that policy and advocates on behalf of physicians and patients in this country on Capitol Hill with CMS, other groups such as the American Hospital Association, the payers, those folks. So we have very good representation and very good working relationships throughout the country. Young men and women coming into this arena now actually come with great passion and enthusiasm, and I am very optimistic. They will continue to be our leaders. They bring a view of health care which reflects change and unsupportive of change, and they are going to be those taking care of us in the future, not only politically, but in policy setting and at the bedside. And I am very optimistic about their enthusiasm and their knowledge. And I will tell you, they are the brightest and the best we have ever seen.
You know, I wanted to get back to reimbursements, and you talked on Medicare and the need to probably stabilize those rates. And putting our hat on as a community health center where we're engaged in providing services to special populations, we know the private physician community also does a tremendous job in this area. And as part of the Affordable Care Act, the rates were increased. They're oftentimes the lowest that a practitioner will receive. But all across the country, states were allowed to sort of nationalize their Medicaid rates by going up to the Medicare levels. Any sense of how the adoption has gone and whether or not physicians across the country are adding more Medicaid patients to their roles?
I will tell you this, the sense in the country right now amongst physicians is they're very concerned about Medicaid expansion only because they're worried about obviously the reimbursement part of it, but are they going to be able to handle the volume? And I say that only because that's what I keep hearing. And my response to this frequently is, you know, these are patients that are already in the healthcare delivery system. They're getting their care at the wrong place at the wrong time by the wrong person, and we need to flip that formula and make it work better. Having said that, I find amongst my physician colleagues a willingness to see Medicaid patients, a willingness to work with the system, and a willingness to work with their states to help make Medicaid delivery in their states the best it can possibly be. It isn't easy sometimes. It's a fiscally troubling issue for many states, as you know. But our physician colleagues out there work at the state level with Medicaid programs and are trying to be very creative and helpful in getting access improved for these patients.
Well, Dr. Hovind, we appreciate that. And I want to appreciate the fact that you, in your practice career, chose to specialize in HIV/AIDS care and became and are just a tremendous advocate for the underserved and very well aware of the health disparities in our country. I know that's something that the AMA is concerned with as well. Perhaps you can share with us a little bit about the AMA's initiatives to address health disparities, and how do you see that work reflected in training and practice and research across the country?
The AMA actually has done several things and continues to do it over the last decade. One of the most important has probably been the AMA's Minority Affairs Section, which serves as a grassroots forum, if you will, for increasing the voice of minority physicians in the AMA itself. This is important because it's an important link to the minority patient population. So what it does is it brings to the AMA a very important perspective to our discussions around issues around disparity and professional concerns. So it provides us real-life, real-time information that enables us as an organization to be much more appropriately reactive to the issues. The Commission to End Health Disparities, another entity, is co-chaired by the AMA and the National Medical Association, again, recognizing that healthcare disparities exist due to multiple factors, including race and ethnicity. And this group works together to increase awareness amongst physicians. You know, the other thing we've been very active in is our Doctors Back to School program. And I'm not sure whether you're aware of it, but physicians and medical students, students across the country visit schools and community organizations to help young minority children realize that they can pursue a career in medicine. Mm-hmm. And it's an exciting thing. The feedback is wonderful. This is not only African Americans, but Hispanics, American Indians. And so we're trying to look and get the the percentage of the physician population to represent the people they serve. And so this is something we talk about and work about.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Artis D. Hoven, president of the American Medical Association. You can learn more about her work and the work of the AMA by going to ama-assn.org. Dr. Hoven, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
Well, in late October, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius testified on Capitol Hill about the troubles with the Health Insurance Exchange website. She said it was illegal for her to obtain insurance herself on the exchanges, which led Colorado Representative Cory Gardner to accuse her of lying. It turns out Sebelius is right. She didn't explain this to Gardner when he was questioning her, but the exchange plans can't be sold to Medicare enrollees. And Sebelius, in addition to having insurance through the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, is a Medicare enrollee. Gardner asked Sebelius why she wasn't in the exchange, and she initially said she has affordable coverage through work, so she's not eligible. That's not correct. Those getting employer-sponsored insurance could buy exchange plans, but it wouldn't make financial sense in most cases, as employers often make sizable contributions toward workers' premiums. Gardner urged Sebelius to find a way to join the exchange, and she blurted out, "It's illegal," with no explanation. Gardner later accused her of lying, but as HHS explained, she also has Medicare Part A, making it illegal for an exchange plan to be sold to her. Meanwhile, Gardner and other members of Congress and their staffers are required by the Affordable Care Act to get insurance on the exchanges in 2014. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Outgoing New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is leaving his post with another public health feather in his cap. Launched in May of 2013, the City Bike bike sharing program has in a few short months reached a milestone. In the first 5 months since the program launched, City Bike users have logged over 10 million miles in over 5 million rides. The program funded by Citibank allows subscribers to join either on an annual fee of $95 or for daily or weekly rates at a far reduced price. Members are given a key that will unlock any of the 6,000 bikes found at the 330 city bike stations in Manhattan and Brooklyn. How popular is the bike sharing program? Very. They're reaching an average daily ridership of 35,000. The estimated number of calories burned since the program began in May, 403 million, the equivalent of 732,000 Big Macs or nearly 419,000 pints of Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia ice cream. Since taking office, Mayor Bloomberg has launched the first city-wide smoking ban in buildings and launched the first in the nation ban on trans fat in restaurants. The bike sharing program has been so successful, the city has plans to scale the program up to all five boroughs, adding hundreds of miles of bike trails and thousands of bikes to newly developed bike stations. And another bonus, the program will, over time, have an impact on the CO2 emissions from cabs and cars. Chicago and Washington, D.C. have similar programs and have plans to scale up their efforts as well. An affordable bike sharing program that has encouraged hundreds of thousands of city dwellers and visitors to exercise their way to their destination, enhancing their health in the process. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.